Welcome back to the second half of Word and Life. And as you can see, Bob has put up some slides, and the first one reminds us of who our speaker is today. And what's the next one, Bob? Thanks to the Brown Group. We're bringing snacks today. They were delicious. Next week is the Blue Group. And our speaker next week is Cyprian Consilio. Okay, so we're powering down. Thank you, Bob, for bringing that to our visual attention. I have one announcement. One of our guiding luminaries in Word and Life, Alice McDonald, is going to be talking at the Cordano Institute for Adult Spirituality Wednesday. It's in 6 days, so it will, it'll be the 17th of October at 7 p.m. at the Mission, and she's talking on the spirituality of Teilhard de Chardin and the holiness of everyday life. So this is something I think in which Alice specializes, and so we might all want to be there. So I'll pass this around. It's at 7 o'clock on Wednesday, October 17th.
The flyers are on the table.
Oh, there's flyers on the table back there. Thanks very much, Judith. So let's return to Suzanne and have some questions and answers. And let me say that the microphone on the stand in the middle of the room is the one to use. So if you can please go there. Otherwise, we won't hear your question. That's the problem. It's being recorded. Thank you very much.
Before we begin our question and answer period, I just would like to share with you one reflection that I had as I was thinking, am I God or am I not God? I laughed, and I was thinking of the first commandment, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have strange gods before you. And I was thinking, if I was God, I would be one of those strange gods. I'm available for one other comment. Somebody kindly pointed out to me that it's Beatrice Bruteau, not Bruteau. I tended to put an R there. It's Bruteau, T-E-A-U. It's a little bit of my French that puts R's every place.
Well, may I be the first to stand up? Okay. I'm going to demonstrate how to use this microphone by asking a question myself. And my question is this. I want to go back to this question of, well, it's almost this Promethean thing. We have a figure in our biblical mythology called Lucifer, who is the bearer of light. And somehow he gets bad rap. And then we have this other image in our biblical and in our spiritual tradition of God as the source of light and us as the prisms that reflect that light. So can you maybe reflect a little on where this light is at any given moment? Is it only from God, or what?
You stumped me, Tom. You stumped me. I've heard you say that before, and I'm not sure. I'm open to other people's reflections on that. Go ahead.
No, I'm not talking about that.
Jesus said, I am the light of the world, and later he said,
you are the light of the world. And where does Lucifer fit in? I was the light of the world. I'll continue to think about it, Tom, but I have no...
Where does Lucifer fit in? Lucifer was the light bearer, but if you remember, and I can't remember which one of the Gospels, I think it was Matthew, Jesus says he saw Lucifer fall like a star from the heaven. So Lucifer fell with his light. Picture a shooting star. It's going out. The light of heaven was no longer with Lucifer because he chose to set himself against God. The Jews have a tradition that when man was made, Lucifer refused to wait on or have anything to do with man. He loved God so much he only wanted God. And so at that point, this is the Jewish tradition. This is not our Christian theology at all. So he was cast out from heaven and took a bunch of angels with him. And the light fell as he fell.
Thank you.
I'm a Canadian who lived in Ontario for many years, the province of Ontario, and we would go down into the Weston Priory area with our tents in the summer and enjoy Vermont so much and enjoy the Priory and come home with their music. And I remember a real time of transition for me, and their music just, I played it and played it and played it. But yesterday I was with a group of chaplains for a peer review for one of them, and this one faces a PhD at Pacifica, defending it next Wednesday. And so her issue for us was, what is my identity? And, you know, she'd moved from, I'm a pastor in a local church, I'm a chaplain in a hospital, I now have this other identity, and we try to work with her with a, you know, she has a lot of new information in her heart and her mind, a lot of strengthening of who she is, but what is, who is she becoming? And we, when I walked in and when I, you know, when you started to go at it there, I thought, this is right on the track of where we were yesterday.
A continuation, huh?
So it really is a deep inner journey, more than outer journey. It's a deep inner journey for her.
A soul journey.
A soul journey for her, mm-hmm. Yeah. So thank you for today. Yeah.
You're welcome. I have to laugh when I heard you say that. I remember when I got my PhD, my family says, well, now how do we send you letters? Is it Dr. Dunn? And then when I was ordained, oh, my God, Sister Reverend Dr. Dunn. I said, none of the above. Just put Suzanne and I'll get it. Any other thoughts, reflections, comments, or questions?
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Don.
My thoughts aren't organized at all, and so I'm taking a risk bringing up. And some of the thoughts I have were spurred by a conversation with Gloria, so I'm stealing some of your thunder maybe, but maybe you'll come up to share what were some of your questions. One of the difficulties I have with some of the articulation of spirit is that at some point it doesn't hold the tension anymore with matter. And it seems to me the incarnation is an incredibly profound story. God didn't think being equal to God something to be clung to, but indeed
himself.
God's self becoming human in every way. So I want to also hold in tension those rational years or those years between like a pre-consciousness and a trans-consciousness as being incredibly important for us. Let me stop there and maybe we could dialogue a little. I'm not saying I heard you denying the incarnation.
Right.
I just wondered if you have the same difficulty I have in continuing to hold matter in all its limitations, because that's what incarnation does. Mm-hmm. It particularizes here and now. It's very much time-bound. Spirit isn't. It's now.
And that is the polarity and the tension. That's why I do like Paul's metaphor of the escalator. In terms of my thinking as I was preparing this article with the escalator is we don't lose our identities, we transcend them. And so those important years of garnering that kind of information and that kind of study is never lost. It is still a part of who we are. And the part of Beatrice's works that I like is that our sense of identity is fluid in that we're not always in spondic energy. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how we would coexist in spondic energy in everyday life. So my thinking is that I was presupposing that those years are important years, and But in terms of my sense of identity and my soul journey, it has contributed to that. Those years of reflection and study, and it still does. I mean, I still like to read a good theological book that challenges my thinking, as well as spiritual books that challenges my soul journey.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll leave it there. And thanks.
Well, it's that tension. That is both and, not either or.
Thank you so much for coming, Suzanne. I was wondering if you would speak about your study or connection with Ken Wilber.
It isn't all that strong, but it's an interesting one in that I think it was my first. I began my PhD work in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Dr. Zilbach was my. She was a psychoanalyst, and she was the head of our cluster group. And so the first unit I studied was developmental psychology. And I chanced upon Ken Wilber's works at that time. And after doing all the traditional theorists, I got into some studies of the evolutionary concept of personality development. Chanced upon Ken Wilber's and took a risk. And so I was going to Cambridge to give my presentation on developmental psychology to see if that course would be accepted, if my work would be accepted. And I did all the traditional understandings of Ericksonian developmental psychology and beyond Ericksonian. And then I introduced some concepts of Ken Wilber in the stages of the evolution of consciousness. And I went through some of his earlier works and just talked about the evolution of consciousness. Well, when the feedback period came, my colleagues ripped me apart. Suzanne, you are in a scientific program. Get your head out of the ethers and come back to the scientific parts of this. And one after another were telling me, don't begin your program this way. You're going to get yourself in big trouble. Dr. Zilbach, on the other hand, was totally fascinated and asked for all the references I had used and was very excited by the presentation. So I had a little bit of both in between, and it was interesting that then I went back as I moved out here to California and studied the biological and all those kinds of studies that were required. My 13th unit, I could choose what I wanted, and I went back to transpersonal psychology. And from the perspective, a little bit of what you were saying, Don, in a way, from the perspective of all of the other works I had done, I had a much deeper understanding of transpersonal psychology, having had what my colleagues were saying, get grounded in the scientific understanding and don't go up in the ethers. Well, that, now I felt grounded and I could still go up into the ethers, but from a different place. That's about it that I can say with Ken Wilber. Other than I like his stages and... Hi, Mary.
Hi, Suzanne. I was wondering, you mentioned when you were in your period as you experienced it as dark night.
Mm-hmm.
When, in a sense of either Kairos or Kronos, were you aware that you were coming out? And how did that feel?
It's a very strange experience, Mary. That was probably... It was very difficult. In Kronos' time, I think it was in my work with the Jungian analysts and in my charting my dreams. So that was telling me that in very many different ways, it was telling me it was time to come out.
Was it volitional on your part to come out?
Yes, it was volitional because a whole part of me... It's funny, a whole part of me had learned to be comfortable navigating in the dark. And coming out, I call it coming out, coming back, coming into the light, I don't know what I would say, I felt extremely vulnerable. And that's why I identified myself as a child of the divine. I felt like a child in that part of my journey, having experienced that. And again, in my professional life, I was not clear how I would put the two together, and probably a lot of what Dawn is bringing out about spirit and matter. Having experienced spirit in a whole different way, still being in matter, how to put the two together.
Was there any particular guide that facilitated this part of your journey for you?
I would say would be Thomas Keating, would have been my guide. The readings by Thomas, I did do a 10-day retreat with him in Snowmass, an understanding of the writings of John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila. That time took on a whole different meaning for me. Opening myself up and sharing with my spiritual director and the group spiritual direction that I was in was helpful. But it was a difficult time. I'm not sure what I felt expectation-wise, but there was something that I think I was feeling expectation-wise would be different, or I don't know what it was. But it was done slowly, and I did it slowly. And hi, Gloria.
Hi, Suzanne. It's great to see you.
Likewise.
And maybe a dialogue. First of all, I feel like I'm in a vulnerable situation with doctors, you and Dawn. So my experience is mostly trying to be fearless and brave here. I think most of my experience, besides reading and therapy, 12-step work, is experiential. And so most everything you say, I tend to see it and agree with, but then there's that other side of me, or other part of me, that says the developmental process, why do we have it? Why is it there? And I think Maria Montessori talked about going back and picking up missed stitches in our developmental stage, which I think is very important. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, how do we, not that you know or I know, but how does one take in the transformational process and the part of us that is what I think is God within us, or spark of God, or whatever, however you phrase that, with the sense of humanity that we have, people that are recovering, people that are alcoholic, people that are in Al-Anon, work these 12 steps, which I think brings them to a sense of humanity that I don't always find in the institutional church. And I say this from, I'm not a recovering alcoholic, but I've gone to so many meetings, I could be one just by sheer presence. But I can tell you the compassion. I was in Al-Anon for many years, so I see these programs integrating all the great religions, so to speak, in our humanity. So I don't even know what I'm asking, other than I think we are called to be the mind of Christ in our humanity and also spiritual. And I think sometimes in this day and age we get into the political aspect too, maybe too much for, you know, I just threw that in there. Anyway.
It's in the air.
Yeah, I know. How about that?
Air.
I know. And I think, anyway, I guess it's, I definitely believe in a sense of humanity, becoming human, and looking at myself as a human being, but with all those developmental stages maybe missed. And, you know, I look at Christ's life, and he had pretty good parents. I said this before. So he went through these development stages pretty well. So those, if we went through those perfectly, maybe we would be like the Christ. Is that, am I making any sense at all up here?
Well, I'm hearing you, and I want to share with you what's going on in my head as I was listening to you. In my own experience, there were times in my prayer life where I felt blocked.
You felt what?
Blocked.
Oh, blocked, yes.
And I sensed that what I needed was therapy. And I went for therapy. And lo and behold, I would remove the block. And there were other times on my psychological journey that it was the spiritual that helped me through. So I've never seen, I see both and, I see that therapy is a very necessary part of our journey. And I've always appreciated Thomas Keating's writings where he talks about when you feel overwhelmed or blocked or whatever, do your therapy. You need to resolve some of those issues. You need to do what you were saying Maria Montessori was. And I don't see that as oppositional, too. I think it's a preparatory. I think it's a opening up the channels, so to speak, within our being for healing whatever developmental places there are. Thomas has a phrase that he uses that he calls divine therapy. And I have come to learn the difference between ordinary therapy and divine therapy. And there are times when I need ordinary therapy, and there are the times when I need divine therapy.
So you're really combining our humanity and our development and the transformational process. That I guess where I'm coming from is, I don't know how to explain it. I just know, I don't know. Other than I think we have an identity in God that we don't lose. Maybe that's what I'm saying.
Maybe that's what the natural faith that St. James talks about. That's the identity that we need to keep looking for and going, searching for and seeing how we can find it within our beings.
The best of who we are.
I would hope so.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't really have a question. I have instead just a flash that has hit me because of your speaking and also because of reading Paul Smith's book. And after listening to all these comments, I get a little distracted because I was totally listening to them. Mm-hmm. But let me just collect myself.
Take your time.
There was something that resonated in me. First of all, logically, he writes so clearly that my head can wrap around what he's saying, and I want to adopt it. But in my heart, there was something that resonated with me as not quite right for me right now, which is exactly what you said at the very end of your speaking. And that was the concept of just wrapping myself completely, buying into the baby divinity thing. Not because I don't think he's right, but rather because I think that as long as what you said this morning, the stages of prayer, as long as there's still an I or a me in my prayer, I'm not one. And as long as you're still opening yourself to God, you're not one. And so, yeah, I guess, you know, we are baby divinities, but we don't want to identify with that exactly, because then we're putting it into our ego self. It makes me think of babies and drives me nuts sometimes when you hear people maybe on the radio reporting a news story, and they'll say, you know, a 12-year-old woman was accosted on the street, you know, or a 15-year-old woman was, you know, this or that. And you know, inside, heck no, she's not a woman. I'm sorry, it's not a demeaning thing. She just isn't. And you can't look at a toddler and say, why don't you just hurry up and be a woman? That's for the lady that just spoke. You know, you have to do what you have to do to turn into a woman or a man. And I think, and remember also in ancient society, especially, and also in Africa today, in equatorial Africa especially, very high infant mortality rates. And we've transcended that in the Western world quite a bit. But in terms of us being baby divinities, I would say, yeah, but we can't own our divinity exactly yet. We're not there yet. I don't mean we collectively. I mean me individually. Mm-hmm. Each person in this room knows when they're there. If you are one, you're not opening yourself, but rather you just are. As you said, I am with the one who is. Then you are the divinity. And until then, you're baby divinity. And unfortunately, at this stage and state of consciousness, we have a very high divinity mortality rate.
Okay. No, I'm hearing it as a commentary, and I'm just reflecting. I have no response.
My own personal spiritual obsession, I think it is intersubjectivity. So when I think of and try to practice practices like contemplative prayer, my understanding is that's geared toward discovering my own soul and my relationship with God, my being in God. And I reflect on love one another as I have loved you. And the external face of love one another as I have loved you is service to others. I'm convinced there are inner spiritual practices of love one another as I have loved you. And if you have insights on that, I'd appreciate them.
I do not believe that any type of mystical or soul experience is for oneself only. If it does not lead out to service, then it becomes purely narcissistically inclined. The depth of oneness is love, and love is to be shared and to be given and to be acted upon. And each person needs to discern for themselves what their call or how they are called to live out that particular dimension of love in their lives. Otherwise, it's too doing it just for oneself. I firmly believe that every time anybody sits in a centering prayer or Christian prayer or Buddhist prayer or whatever, there is a getting in touch with a form of energy that is being put out into the world. I believe in group practice of centering prayer when we meet on Tuesdays. I truly believe that there is energy that goes out in the room and from the room to the world. That isn't enough. There also has to be concrete. Put it using that energy in a concrete way in the role of service. What that service is not. It's dependent on your own individual call and your own listening to the needs around you and what attracts you in your role of service. But I agree with you. It's not just for sitting there.
Hi, Suzanne. My name is Mike Bishop. We've met before.
Yes, we have, Mike. Yeah, I recall.
I escaped from Montpelier. How did you escape from St. Johnsbury?
I still love St. Johnsbury. I feel I have the best of two worlds. I was there for a few days in the fall. I try to go back every year in the fall. It's my favorite season.
Yeah, it's. We had a chance to share before,
right,
at Mass, but. I've also had a chance to be with you when ordinations took place at Congregational Church. Was it 2 years ago or three that two women and one man was ordained?
It was 3 years ago.
3 years ago, yeah.
There was one deacons and one priest was ordained.
I was thinking that maybe in the last minute or so you talk a little bit about your priesthood and your ministry.
Is that something people would want?
That's who you are.
At present. Oh, dear. Talk about my priesthood and ministry. I bring a lot more people with me in my prayer life. What I see currently going on in my personal life vis-a-vis my community, the Church of the Beatitudes, is I feel fortunate that I am with a group of people who will hone me. And I feel honed by my community. And I appreciate that. We are wanting in our Church of the Beatitudes to set up what Vatican II described as the church of the future, the people of God. And so I feel that every person in my community is equally valuable to myself and to Jeanette, who is our other priest. We have no model for that. We are creating the model. And sometimes it's wonderful and sometimes it's hell. But we are walking the journey together. And it has been a tremendous learning experience for me, and I am deeply, deeply grateful to every member of my community that comes. And we've taken the walk together, where the Church of the Beatitudes is going into the future. We do not know. We only know where it is now. We envision where it might be. We have empowered our community members to own their own gifts and talents and to express them and manifest them. I am exceptionally proud of each member of the Church of the Beatitudes. How have I grown and changed with them? It's a learning experience. I think we're at the place, which is exciting for me, where we have been in existence long enough, along with other communities in California who've been in existence maybe a little longer than us, San Diego 5 years, and we, in 2 weeks we're meeting together in San Diego. I think they'll be representing 4 or 5 communities to start visioning and saying, where are we going as a church? Not only the local church, but the larger church. It's a unique situation that we're in, and we're creating it as we go along. And I feel very blessed to be a part of the creation experience and the creation process. I see the RCWP movement growing. I was witnessing an ordination last week, and the youngest person we have was ordained 39 years old. And then we ordained a 70-year-old. So we still have both ends of the spectrum, but more and more of people in their late 30s, 40s, and 50s are applying, and people of different nationalities are beginning to apply. So I see two different processes going on in RCWP, is that more people are feeling the call to ordination, and those of us who have been ordained are feeling a need to start connecting and seeing how are we as we connect? How are we as we come together with different groups having met? And where do we see this movement heading and growing? It's very exciting to be a part of that dynamic, ongoing process. It truly is. But we have no answers. More questions. Worldwide, we are about 110 Roman Catholic women priests at this time, worldwide. And after the CTA meeting in Milwaukee, all of the RCWP bishops worldwide will be meeting for 1 week together, all with the exception of one who cannot fly. She is in Germany. And the goal is to, again, vision, and okay, we've got women ordained, we've got parishes, groups started, communities, I would prefer, than parishes, and what's our ongoing vision? How are we going to come together and be together as one? It's new. It's very new. Jeannie?
I just wanted to ask Suzanne, strange God, if the Beatitudes, like Vatican II, was centered on collegiality. Is there a strong seed of collegiality in Beatitudes framework?
That's the hellish part, yes. There is a strong seed of collegiality, and we are learning how to do that. The community I belong to, Sisters for Christian Community, was founded after Vatican II, and it was based on collegiality and on our living the Gospels and the documents of Vatican II. So I have seen collegiality at its worst, and I've seen it at its best. Collegiality is probably one of the greatest processes there is, but it's also one of the most frustrating. We have to learn how to operate collegially. When it starts to function and to work, it is a wonderful model. Unfortunately, we all bring our wounded selves to the process. And once we can learn to separate out what is our woundedness and our insistence or whatever, then it opens up a whole wide possibility.
I wanted to share that I worked in a group for 30 years that lived collegiality. That was their base. And it takes forever. It's such a long process. But once you experience collegiality, then hierarchical structures are really difficult to
deal. I think one of the happiest moments I've had recently was at our collegial assembly in Canada this year for Sisters for Christian Community, where we were sitting at tables doing the collegial process around one of the proposals that had been submitted. And in the past, where we spent years wordsmithing and, you know, just everybody had to have the right word and they didn't like this word because and blah, blah, blah. I heard at my table someone say, you know, I don't like the way it's worded, but I think that that can be worked on afterwards. She says, I agree with the concept. And I was ecstatic. I thought, we have moved in our community to a place where we can get beyond this personal need to have every word in dot and T dot crossed and I dotted, to a place where we can hear conceptually what a thing is about and go forward with the concept and then ask the group to return and maybe rephrase it some way or else. But that's a whole different place. And it's truly a wonderful experience when that happens.
Okay, I'm encouraged by somebody in the back to please ask this question. We're excited about this 110 women priests. I think this is huge evolution.
Mm-hmm.
What does the Vatican think of all of this and the hierarchy? And I know this isn't a short answer, but how are you reconciling yourself to the hierarchy?
Well, at this stage, the Vatican is not accepting Roman Catholic women priests and have issued in 2008, I believe, or 10. No, it was 8 because I was part of it at that time. An edict that says that any woman who attempts to be ordained and any person who attempts the ordination are automatically excommunicated. And I think that's still their position. How are we reconciling? It's pretty difficult to reconcile such opposing viewpoints, but we have chosen at this point in our development to stay within the Roman Catholic Church, and I think that is very difficult for the hierarchical church to accept, that we are continuing to place ourselves in the Roman Catholic tradition. We call ourselves Roman Catholic women priests. We feel that we are disobeying an unjust law and that they can excommunicate us, but we do not accept the excommunication.